Welcome to the Global Product Management Talk, the Lean Startup Spec Product Definition Series Discussion, ongoing saga with Malcolm Knapp. I'm Hello. Cindy F. Solomon of Startup Product Academy. Delighted to be here and to include you in these discussions, which I'm learning quite a bit from the hardware engineering perspective in our guests. And here is Malcolm Knapp.
Hi, I'm Malcolm Knapp. I am the founder of the Engineer Accelerator, where we are doing a professional training program for hardware engineers to give them the professional skills they need to be effective in their career.
And we're posting the archive of the series in a couple places. One is blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. It's the Global Product Management Talk channel. You can also hear Chad McAllister's series on innovation, as well as past Global Product Management Talk interviews with some thought leaders. It's also available at startupproduct.com under podcasts, and also on your website.
Yes, on my website, you can find it. The whole series on it's engineeraccelerator.com/projects, and you'll see the Lean Spec discussions.
And you can also find it on iTunes. So
many places.
Yay!
Distribution is so easy.
Right. Although I would say this is really, we haven't promoted the process or the training.
Yes.
This is the behind the scenes development
yes,
of
yes,
that.
Yes, you're seeing it all as it goes. So. Yeah, so...
So today we're talking about capturing what a product does versus what a product is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think this is, you know, this goes back to this sort of initial thing for me, is that you would get this bulleted list, and what I sort of realized, it was this combination of these two things, is that a lot of people think about features or functionality. They put these two things together, where you have something like, you know, it has a battery, or it has, you know, the sort of, it's going to be this, you know, the size of a bread box or something like that. That is the sort of, you know, the way what it is, you know, with sort of what it does when, you know, the temperature goes over, you know, 50 degrees C or something like that, or like what happens, you know, how it behaves, or what it does when through time, you know, in some way.
I was thinking, well, that's like the mechanics of the product.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the other way you can think about it is that there is the car, right? There's all the things the car is. It has wheels. It has an engine and all sort of stuff like that. But then there's what it does is like when you do the blinker, you know, thing, blinker sort of lever. Well, a light starts blinking inside. One of the lights, which is part of what it is, blinks. Inside and the light on the lights outside also blink, but that's not necessarily the case. You know, it's also like, you know, how fast do they blink? You know, do they blink it like really, really, really fast? Do they blink like once a minute? You know, those, you know, differences mean something, right? You know, once a minute and a car blinker is not very useful, but it's the same light blinks. You know, so being precise about how you talk about behavior of systems is really, really important. And I think it's one of the things that is, you know, sort of missed a lot of times, because there's usually a lot there that has to be thought about. And again, it's sort of, if you don't think about it at the beginning, it shows up when you're in the middle of the process and you realize we have to have a sequence for this. There has to be something that goes on and you sort of make it up on the fly. And so and the other thing about it is that, you know, capturing behavior and how to, you know, efficiently talk about it is different than capturing, you know, features or what a product is.
Right.
We talked about some stuff before about this sort of, you know, this, you know, hierarchical list, the sort of feature list. We talked about, and, you know, the sort of, you know, system blocks are really good ways of capturing, you know, what it is.
And we're still talking about the full product, because as you're talking, I was thinking, well, there would be different engineering teams working on the different pieces of the product. Like, there may be the blinker experts, which are different than the direct, you know, the steering wheel experts and the brake experts.
Yep.
And certainly that's would be true if we're talking about a mobile app, if we're talking about anything that includes hardware and software.
Yeah, so it is one of those things that, you know, at the low level, there's a lot of specialized knowledge. But you can, but you know, for a user and for most functionality, you know, what happens is pretty easy to describe. And so you can capture it, you know, in a short number of words, basically.
Well, but in the user, if we are talking about the true end user, I have no clue how the car works. And they're making it even simpler. I won't even have to know how to drive a car to get where I'm going.
Yes.
And that's all I care about is the experience of how it delivers me to my goal.
Yeah. And so, but the key thing, though, is that the sort of skill we're talking about, you know, what is the skill you learn, is how to translate, sort of how to describe those, you know, what it does in a way that then can be made, you know. Because, you know, behavior is like a lot of times talk, well, it should be easy to use. Well, that's something that is not, it's too vague what
that
means.
Well, that describes an experience.
Yeah.
A human experience. It doesn't just really tell you anything about the technical aspects of the product.
You can't make something that's you don't put easy to made sauce on or easy to use sauce on it. You just like that you have to translate it into something that you can make. And so there's it's pretty straightforward in many ways, but there's the first very simple thing is just that behavior is sequences of steps.
Right.
You know? It's that first, you know, when you're in a car, if we're doing the car theme today, you know, you're at a stoplight and, you know, there's a sequence of steps that the lights go through. And that is the behavior of the system. And so...
And that actually is the whole field of artificial intelligence and robotics is how do we break down things that humans can do? We have to break each thing down into a piece of code is very difficult.
It's difficult, but it's also, but the thing is, it does have to actually be broken down in that way.
Yep.
And, you know, the artificial system is dealing with much more complex problems most of the time than lots and lots of products. And so for those, breaking things down into sequences are easier. But the thing is that the key thing to point out is that's different than we talked about earlier, characteristics of features, you know. The colors, you know, the number of colors in a screen is different than the animation that happens on the screen. Because that number of colors determines what you have to buy or find as a component. Whereas the complexity of the animation you have to create maps into how much code you have to write, you know. And how, you know, all those sort of how many pictures you have to draw and things of that sort. And so separating those two things out and be able to sort of, you know, see the interaction between them is very, very important. And so sequences are very easy, but it's in some, one of these sort of things is that humans don't think in sequences. They think it's sort of all automatically done most of the time. You know, when you're learning something for the first time, you do the sequence. But, you know, for example, you know, a light turning on and off, a blinking light. Well, you as a human being will say the light blinks, but in a computer, in the sequence is that the light turns on and then stays on for X amount of time and then turns off, you know. So that's the sequence breakdown of a light blinks, you know. And this very similar things you have to do to really describe behavior precisely. You have to get down. You have to sort of again to get to another level of detail and formality, you know. You don't have to sort of there's always a sort of, you don't have to get the really, really precise sort of stuff, but there's a level you have to get to. We talked about specificity. But to really bound what's happening, you have to be precise. And, you know, that is a lot of work, but it's a lot of work. It's not something you can it's not something you can sort of avoid.
You can't automate it.
You know, well, it's more just that, you know.
You can't automate the thinking of the step by step.
Yeah. Someone's going to do it at some point. And the question is, do you want to do it at the beginning of a project when you start seeing whether the interactions between things, when you can change things really easy, or do you want it to the coder or the sort of down the sort of at the low level 6 months in to just make the decision on their own, you know?
And I want to frame that because that's the value of this whole process. How how much of this can we capture to be thinking about it up front before it's a problem later on because it wasn't spelled out.
And so that's you can do a lot. We were talking about is that, you know, it's also that when you're doing code, it'll take you can it just takes a lot of time to write out a sequence because, you know, you have to code it up, you have to do all the syntax rules and stuff like that. Whereas you're doing this sort of stuff, you go on a whiteboard or just listing the stuff, you can write it in 3 minutes or 5 minutes, even 10 steps or something like that. Or, you know, and if it's 100 steps, well then, you know, you have to deal with 100 steps. Like, that's really, really, you know. And then you may have to sort of, you know, break it down more, but then you know, you reveal the complexity of the behaviors you're trying to capture. And you know up front that what you're trying to do is just really, really, you know, this is some serious work in there, you know, and we'll get to it in a bit, but you can actually then translate those, each sequence into the number of sequences you have, each one of those maps into how much time it's gonna take to make, right? If you have 10 different sequences, well, that's, you know, for one, you time to figure that thing, and you can multiply by 10. So you start being to input how complex the product is into how long, into your estimate how long it's going to take to get done. In a very in a very precise way, like there's an actual mapping between the two. But that's for the future. So the thing is that, you know, that's the work. I mean, this is sort of, we talked, you know, this can get, you can get bogged down, or you can get sort of feel like there's a lot of stuff going on. Like, why am I writing out all these sort of things? Well, someone's going to have to do it, and you really have to get down to that level to really then know, see the interactions between the hardware, what it is and what it does. And then you can start simplifying things. You can say, well, I'm dealing with 50 steps here. That seems complicated. Can I make it down less, you know? Is there a way we can simplify this at this moment, you know, before it's embedded in code? So that's sort of the simple way of describing, that's sort of, you know, procedural programming in some ways, just sequences. Now there's more complex ways of this capturing things. The other thing I wanted to talk about was a state machine, which is another skill. It's like, what is a state machine? How do you sort of map reality over into a state machine? But so have you heard of that term? Do you know what that is?
Is it a mechanical engineering term?
No, it's not. It's actually a code term. It's for, yeah. So basically it says that any system will go through different states as it works, basically. Will sort of enter different states. So you can, you know, when you turn on a computer, there's a startup sequence, you know, where you can't, the keyboard doesn't work and the mouse doesn't work and you see some graphics on the screen, then that's a sort of startup state, you know. But then it loads, and then you get you can do all the windows, you can do all your programs, that's sort of use state. But then there's also like the blue screen of death, the classic blue screen of death is like an error state, you know. And basically the states are associated with sort of persistent behaviors, you know, for things that happen over a long period of time. So, you know, like I said, you know, what inputs allow you to do, you know, what inputs are registered is the sort of types of behavior. You know, does the keyboard work? Does when you type on the keyboard, does letters appear on the screen? Well, that's consistent through the whole time you're using a computer that's on, basically, and it's in a normal sort of state. Then there are events, which is the things that happen that so begin and end. So the button press is an event. It starts and it stops. And events themselves are triggers to do something. And a lot of times they're triggers to do a sequence. So when you double click on a icon on the computer, it triggers a sequence to open the program. And there's sort of a bunch of things that come up. The loading screen comes up, and then, you know, the window appears, and then your most recent work appears, and or whatever it is. You know, there's a sequence associated with that. So that you see that there's a combination of the two things. But the other thing that an event can do is make you go from one state to another. So if you if you get a virus, or a virus sort of does something bad, that triggers an event that causes the blue screen of death, or you short your computer, that can cause a bad thing to happen, then that is a that's registered in the system and says we have a big problem. We're going to jump to the error state and show the screen and so forth. You know, so now this model is really, really powerful because, you know, for example, any a menu system in like an LCD screen can be described. Each screen is a state. And so it allows you to control when things are drawn on the screen and what in the same input can mean different things depending on what state you're in. So I did one which was a, you know, simple LCD screen, but I had just a couple of a keypad, and at one point it was just entering numbers for like a telephone, and the other time it was changing menus, like it was a selection, you know, and just by changing the state internally, I could capture both of those situations. So it applies in, you know, state machines are show up everywhere. In like code, they're like embedded in like most code. There's something in there. And OSs are sort of, you know, are sort of it's a more advanced version of that. Like they're sort of they're even more powerful. Like you can start with a state machine, then you have an OS, which is even more powerful and even more able to do things. So, they show up a lot of times. They're really great for mapping, you know, for representing many, many different types of behavior. You know, I've done LCD screens. There was one where an artist was, you had to do this thing where you were racing against the projected animals on a screen, and she had two laser tripwires. So we set up a state machine to control the you had to sort of select which animal you wanted to race against, and then you wanted to start the race and end the race and who won, and each one of those things we can map it out and control it very, very easily with a state machine. So it was great. It was a really great project, and it worked really well. And it, otherwise, it's very hard to do if you're not using that type of sort of structure. So this is a skill about like how do you look at the world, and or how you look at your product and figure out what states does it have, A, and what events show up in it, and then what are the sequences that come from those events, you know. So I use it in, you know, in the description of sort of capturing that aspect, the sort of the what product does. This is really, really powerful, I think. So you know, and then there's a question about how do you know, that you can make visual state diagrams. I also like, there's one that I sort of translated the form into a sort of just a listed like text format of a state machine. And that means that you can then put it in the text file, just as you had put in this sort of characteristics list. You could put that in a text file. And so therefore, again, you have very light, you know, sort of your tool is very light. You know, you can just have it in a text file and change it as you need to, and add and remove things very, very easily. So, you know, I mean, I guess that's one sort of interesting question. You just heard me describe, you know, what it is. Now, in your experience, does this sort of map over? Could this be useful to you as you sort of think about in your experience when you've been dealing with products and sort of talking about that?
Well, actually, I was thinking that the terminology is quite precise.
Yes.
And thinking about how to talk about the state of the product at various places in its life.
Yeah.
Well, would be actually more of an accurate description than currently we refer to it the product life cycle.
Yeah.
But that's kind of vague.
Well, the product life cycle is also not a usage session.
Right.
It's
not a technical term.
It's about, you know, introduction of the product, the product's in production, or being, and then it goes end of life, and then you know, that sort of stuff like that. And that's slightly different.
Right.
You know.
But that's what I was thinking of, applying the state of the product development to train product managers to identify better what they need to do and what they need to be focused on, and even how to manage this ideally 360 view of the product to make them more effective and strategic.
Yeah, and so I think that is also, I mean, that's the thing, is that this metaphor in some way is applicable everywhere. I mean, there's a classic phases of a project.
Right.
Is
phases, right.
Basically the same, the word that's used in that domain.
Right.
But it's the same idea. But states can also be, multidimensional. You can have a state where you know, if you have an error condition or you have something that happened goes wrong, no matter what else has been happening, whatever state you were in before, you jump to that error state. And so it means that you can jump from any state to any other state so long as the technology allows it, you know. So it's not just a sequence, and that's what makes it different than just a list of steps, you know. Because sometimes something will happen and you'll stay in the same state. You won't actually change, you know. So it's more, I mean, maybe we can sort of step back and sort of say there is this question of, like, you know, what a product does, and, you know, have you sort of, does that distinction make sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's I think the key concept is that you separate these two things out.
And it is a, it is a key distinction because, again, the technical people want to talk about what the product does, but the marketing people want to talk about what the product is. How are we selling this?
Well, that's the thing.
The narrative of it has to include both.
Mm. Well, I think that's a very good point to bring up, but it's more that the marketing people must understand both what it is and what it does.
Right.
And if they're vague about it, then it actually makes it easier. If you can understand the distinction between the two, it's actually easier to talk about.
Right.
Because
they don't want to really know how it does what it does.
No.
But depending on the complexity of the product, the salespeople need to know to some extent how it does what it does.
Well, they need to know what it, I mean, in some ways we were talking about, this is what we want the product to be able to do. You know, in many times you don't know how you're going to do it yet.
Right.
But you want it to be able to do this.
Right.
And so, I was talking about this, you know, I actually was doing this, a sort of website with, had some hardware attached to it, you know, sort of using a hardware sort of validation sort of purposes and sort of identification and stuff. And we had actually the person who was marketing it, like, in the room while we were talking about this. He's saying, this is really great. This gives me the terminal, you know, we talked about naming. This gives me the ways to talk about this much more clearly than I could before. You know, I didn't know, you know, because now I understand the interplay between this sort of stuff, what's going on, what the product really, you know, is without the sort of, and again, this very, very high level, you know. You don't have to know the internal code or the voltages or whatever. You just have to know what it is and what it does. And so that was very useful to them. So again, I'll sort of go back, is that, I mean, now describing things in state machine format, I mean, you know, have there been situations, or in the sort of more formal structure, have there been cases where you've seen that could be useful?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. So,
I'm thinking of a couple of startups that were too early on in mobile that I was involved in, and even in early smart browsers for the phone.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the thing is that, I think one of the other key things to bring out is that people in some ways think that, well, we just put it in code and we'll just figure it out then. And the issue is that because what behaviors impact what it needs to be, what it is. And I think that's really should be brought to the surface,
But to that point, I think people solve problems with the tools they are familiar with.
Mm. Yeah.
And so that's one of the issues, right, with software engineers.
Yeah.
They want to solve everything with software.
Mm-hmm.
And what this process is a little bit like design thinking, counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. If we're saying we're going to review how to solve this problem before we apply the tools we have at our fingertips.
Well, we're going to do it without the sort of the domain like constraints in some way. I mean, just words on a text file or whatever like that, or on a, you know. Drawings on a board.
Pseudocode.
You don't have to, it doesn't have to be feasible.
Right.
At least as, you know, you can still write it down, you know. And then you can figure out if it is. And so I think that, but I think that this is one of those things that behavior does impact, you know, what the product is. Just as much what the product is impacts behavior. But I think, and that's the key thing to sort of bring out is, you know, that's why it's useful to go through this process up front with this part of the product.
And that's where I see it being so beneficial to startups who mm-hmm. haven't yet defined what technology mm-hmm. should be used, as well as it's the product manager who should be determining that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
or using this process to identify what needs to be determined.
Well, this was a thing from last week that David was saying. Part of my process is doing a feasibility study.
Right.
And for me, you know, I can see why that's compelling. I mean, that sort of makes sense. But I also think that there is some interesting thing. But the thing that my issue with it is it basically could be potentially unbounded how much work you have to do to validate what you're doing, validate things.
Right.
And so
you're constrained by time and
so you
money.
Have, but the thing is potentially. I mean, so for me, what I want this process to be is something that's really, you can sort of go through it and be done. And part of it, it's about there's a slightly different question than feasibility. You have to answer that question, definitely. But for me, in this phase, what I like to say is, what do you want the product to do in the best case scenario? Like, because then that...
In an ideal world with no constraints?
Yeah. Well, it's just sort of like, in the ideal result in some way, like, and then you have to, like, you know, see if that's actually possible.
Right.
And then you have to adjust the product definition to match that. But it's also just sort of, if you're then starting from that point, then you look for that solution versus just focusing in on, like, what we know is possible, you know.
And that is a design thinking approach.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it, is that
being empathetic for who the ultimate end user is and what we want to enable them to do, or what problem we want to solve.
Mm. Yeah, and so I think that you know, it's a small thing, but when you you know, not starting a process by saying, well, we have these technologies, you know, work, and we validated them
exactly,
and then that's what we're going to build from. Then saying, well, what we want to do, and then see if this technology is out there. And then you get into this question of, like, build or buy, because you can always build something, you know, but it's a different question than...
That kind of goes to the order of the startup product principles.
Mm.
You know, you start with the people first, then you identify, well, what knowledge is necessary, then you look at what is an appropriate process, and tools or technology are the last thing in that consideration. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's what happens if people start, well, we want to use these tools.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that, you know, engineers know the tools they have, know the tools they want to use. But that potentially can be constraining.
Yes.
And you get into narrow focus about, you know, what you know, you know, what then the features that are feasible.
Right.
And
that's what I was thinking. That this process actually is a key component of a feasibility study. It's not the financials.
Mm.
It's not the business case. But if we were to explain this to a business side or business analyst, as this is almost a technology feasibility, it has a component of that.
Well, it's there's a component of that, but there's also this thing about, if you could do, what do you want? What's the vision of the product? What do you want to do? What do you want it to be? And what do you want it to do?
And then, is it possible? And we're going to have
and then
this process to determine that.
You start with saying, well, we'll just sort of not do the feasibility stuff first, and just start listing what we want it to be able to do. And then, of course, you have to go through the feasibility.
But that actually is the appropriate process, because how could you test whether it's viable or not until you know what it is?
And then you also know if that one feature really is what you need in there or not.
I mean, that's also an issue in feasibility, is that, it's different in regulated pharmaceuticals, and but in software, they have a grand vision, but not, you're talking about a granular vision that we're spelling out
here. Well, the thing is that you have to, you want to end up with a definition of what you can build. And there is a thing, and but the thing is that what we talked about right now so far is, you know, it's a characteristic list, a flow diagram, a sequences and state machine, and not all those are possible, you know. So there's questions of like performance, you know. I mean, David was, we were talking about it later, that, you know, he gets a certain amount of performance with her, with the, you know, they can't get day resolution or whatever, like, but they can get week resolution, you know. But that's different than, and so that's something that's that they wanted, they couldn't quite get. But
I don't, you know, also, yeah. I don't think they knew about it at the beginning. That came up in beta use or in customer. Well, it's a customer driven feature request.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think that I think that that's, but that's a sort of the what it does is still, it's it, that they still want a reporting, you
right?
Know, and they still got it.
To your point, if they thought that was important at the beginning, they may have coded differently.
Yeah, they would have done a looked for a different product, you know, looked for a different like third party product to do that. And so, you know, again, we talked about the sort of hierarchical information. Sometimes some one little detail is really, really, really important. You know,
that's another key benefit of this process, that we have this light documentation describing the product definition of what to be built, but that's enough to then go do customer development, because hey, we're all aligned with this description, now let's test if this description is accurate and could be sold and would be useful, and what did we leave out?
Well, you can, but the thing is that then you can actually go through to someone and say, well, this is a sequence I'm thinking about. You can do paper prototypes. You can do whatever else you want. You can do that sort of thing. You can do that sort of user testing, or you can go through a feasibility study and look and see if you can actually get technology to do the lists of features and behaviors that you want. And if you can't, that was really important to know at the beginning, you know. But it also means that you have the, you may have a big question mark about this set of features. Is this feasible? Question mark, question mark, question mark. And you focus on that first, where versus, like, you know, a lot of times people will focus on the stuff they know how to do first, you know, and like get bogged down in that, or like get really focused on that. And then when this, but then when they hit the sort of showstopper, like, it's already way too late, you know. So, you know, this is the question, you know, this is sort of the thing, is if your engineers are saying, you know, well, I don't know if that behavior or that feature is possible, that's a big red flag for you to know that that's the next thing you have to get into and figure out if it's really going to work. You know, and when I do my stuff, I sort of say architecture, one of the things you're doing is you're doing proof of concept tests in the sort of architecture phase, quote unquote, because architecture is about generating or knowing how you're going to realize something, how you're going to make it.
So could this be the product concept definition?
Well, possibly. I mean, the thing is that, you know, we have an issue about that product has been is overloaded.
Right. What
do
we mean by that?
Well, but it means just for product managers,
totally
it means
contextual.
It means very specific, and but it's also not directly associated with the sort of the physical or the sort of artifact you're making, whatever it ends up being.
Right.
And for me, that's the thing that I want to, the connotation of whatever the name is.
Right.
I mean, I want to be have a connotation of the thing that was in that the thing that is made.
Right.
You know, and so that's why I like the product definition. But if we can't use that word, I looked around actually, and there's like, you know, lots of other words, but they don't quite, you know, like.
Well, it's a product definition. It's a definition of the product to be made.
Yeah.
Almost in parentheses.
Yeah. Yeah. But it just sort of, that's a long.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it just sort of, I mean, you know, I was
it's
looking
at. It's definitely lean.
Yeah. Well. Yes. It's what is it? You know, 85% lean or whatever, 91% lean or whatever it is. Um, So just sort of that is this is one of the skills, is like, how do you separate these two things out from each other? And sometimes it's you know, I'm not saying there's a hard and fast line here, but I think that there's and sometimes it's a little hard to parse things out, but the idea that you can is really powerful. I also want to point out one sort of small aside, which is to say, we talked about block diagrams, and those are actually capturing behavior as well. What they're capturing is flows of information or flows of power or signals and stuff like that, which is also behavior. It's things happening in time, but it's sort of continuous things versus the state machine, which is capturing sort of discontinuous.
The other thing is that this process enables us to almost have a 3D understanding of the product.
Well, exactly. That's the point.
Not literally.
No. Yeah.
But figuratively.
Yeah. conceptually, that's the whole thing about seeing the product from these different aspects. And
so it's a product definition concept.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think
conceptual product definition.
Well, the thing is that I had functional definition, but functional is also overloaded as well.
Right, yeah.
You know, functionality definition, but the functionality is not quite enough, physical enough, or like real enough for me. I don't anyway. So we're getting closer, I think. But
so we're gonna have to have a total discussion, bring in a linguist.
Yes. Yes. Well.
Technical, maybe a tech writer or a user documenter.
Yeah. 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 So, I think we'll probably get somewhere, but it's just sort of, we may need to go to a different language or something. Like that.
Yeah.
Japanese worked for many people, so.
Yeah.
Just use the Japanese word for products.
Right.
Well,
that was I was in a huge organization and we used Japanese terminology for the different processes. There's a Japanese term for straw man.
Mm.
So when we were in discovery, someone got to be the straw man, and then they kind of came, they stood up for, here's a vision, I have the product, but then everyone threw sticks at them. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of the things we're talking about. I think that it's a really, really important skill, and I think that it's really powerful again when you get practice in it.
Yeah.
Because the thing is that the ultimate location in actual technology is very, very different.
Yes.
For what it is and what it does generally. Right. I mean, you can do some stuff that's like, you can make hardware behavior happen in hardware, hard coded, but it's much harder than in code. So a lot of times, behavior maps generally to code, software, firmware, stuff like that, and what it is or features map generally to sort of mechanical and electrical and so forth. And so you end up with different domains. So it's really good to separate them out when you're at the very beginning, because they'll be implemented differently a lot of times as well. So, cool.
And that's why it's critical for product managers to learn this process, because it enables them to have the thinking for any type of product they're going to go into, and also accelerates their career, because generally they'll be expert or they'll be involved in one piece of product. And so many of them will come to me frustrated. Well, I didn't. This isn't why I got into product management, to be a slave to the engineers, or to only be focused on the backlog or the certain functionality. Mm. I cared about the whole product.
Yeah.
And this process extends their visibility give them the language, the understanding, how to work cross-functionally. It's a very powerful tool.
Yeah. So these concepts we've been talking about are applicable to every sort of all domains.
Right.
From mechanical, electrical, so forth. So you don't have to know the whole domain to be able to speak to that domain.
Right. I mean, the reason for product managers to have domain knowledge is it increases the ability to speak to the technical people and gain that respect.
Mm-hmm. But it also is, and so I think what we're trying to identify are the sort of, in some ways, the minimum set of conceptual skills or sort of conceptual understanding that you need to be able to talk across different domains.
Right. Awesome.
Great.
Thank you.
Always fun.
I think this was session 17.
Session 17, yes.
And we're getting deep.
Yes. I think we have a few more things to go over, but I think we're starting to get towards a good list of stuff.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
So thank you, Malcolm.
Yeah.
And thanks to our listeners. And join us again on the Global Product Management Talk channel and at startupproduct.com. And check out the EngineerAccelerator.com.
Yeah.
Have a great week.
Talk to you soon.